Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Is 2 10-minute speakers and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Jack G.
Thanks, Malik. My name is Jack and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Malik, for that long pause for me to catch my breath before I came up here. Thank you, Mary, for asking me to do this. It's always kind of overwhelming to have an opportunity to speak at this particular meeting, my home group, but especially today because it is my sobriety date. And I have completed 12 years of sobriety.
Feedback. Now it's a radio show.
Is that too much? I can hear some feedback. Are you all right? Copy. Check, check. Lydian, check. Check, check. Lydian. Okay. yeah, it gives me an opportunity to say thank you to all the incredible examples in this room who have shown me how to do this thing, man. I don't know. I just, you know, Mitch and I talk about it all the time about how lucky we are, you know. The fact that we got sober here. Sometimes we take it for granted. And it just, you know, this morning I woke up and I just had this, you know, wave of gratitude wash over me because it just struck me how lucky we are. You know, with all the things that we've seen over the past couple of years, with the people that have passed away and on and on and on and on, the hardship that we've all had to go through, the fact that we're here, you know, is just astonishing. It really, really struck me this morning, and to see you all here tonight just makes me really, really happy, super grateful to have another sober day with y'all, you know? Yeah, and November 10th, 2009, that's my day. That was the day that I went to Sunday Night, Ohio, and I've been sober since that day, and I owe it to the examples in this room. I don't know how that happened. I really don't, man. I did not want to get sober. I mean, all I really wanted to do was stop drinking. All I wanted to do was feel like I could, like, live again in my skin. You know, I was so sad and so desperate and so angry. Mitch will tell you that I was like a sucked-up lizard, like a gecko in a, had a big overcoat with a burn from a motorcycle, and, like, I was 25 pounds lighter than I am now and just angry. Super angry that I had to get sober, you know. It's not what I wanted. I thought for sure that that was the worst day of my life when I walked into Ohio Street. I knew it. I knew it. And I knew this wasn't going to work. And, of course, I was wrong about all of that, you know. I mean, I started drinking when I was around 14. I was raised in basically an only child. I had an older half-brother and half-sister that looked after me. I thought that they resented the fact that they had to watch me when I was a kid, too, and my brother started blowing pot smoke in my face and feeding me beer when I was like 10. And, you know, I have these abandonment issues and trust issues and all that based on my upbringing. And I don't think that any of that makes me an alcoholic. As a matter of fact, I don't know what does. And it's better that I don't know. Because if I try to figure things out, I just come up with a bad decision. You know, it's better that I don't figure this out. What I do know for sure is that I am one. I am an alcoholic. I just know it. I've heard your stories over and over and over again, and it talks about me. It says who I am in that book. And I have no doubt that that's what's going on with me, you know? And it's a blessing to know what's wrong because I didn't know what was wrong for a really long time. You know, alcohol solved a lot of problems for me. It did for me things that it doesn't do for the normal folks that I've talked to. It made me feel like I could be okay in the world. You know, it felt like I could be in the moment with you. I felt like I could be on the planet. Like the world was beautiful if I knew I was going to have a drink or if I had one in me. You know, I could be here with you. I could breathe. It was okay. The world was going to be okay. If I just knew I was going to get loaded soon, it was like, yes, this is going to be a good day, man. Whew, I can live. I can breathe. You know, it did that for me. And I wanted to continue to do that as soon as I had one. You know, all the things that I wanted to be when I was a kid kind of went into the back seat once I started drinking. And I chased that for a long time. You know, it worked for me for a really, really long time until it didn't. And slowly, alcohol started to take away all the things that it had given me. You know, I needed more and more just to be as confident as I once was. And, you know, it gave me permission to not be a very good dude. You know, I'm not a very good guy on the natch. I lie, steal, cheat. I was raised basically a spoiled brat kid, so I'm always looking for what's for me, what's about, how is this going to affect me, what's in it for me, and get out of my way. And alcohol gave me the permission to be that guy. this auditorium reminds me very much of when I was in junior high, and I just had a flashback when we got drunk and went to the prom, and it was the classic situation where the girls were on one side and the guys were on the other, and Kathy Hemphill, like the most attractive girl in the school, was walking by us, and she was kind of just looking at the line, you know, and I was drunk, and so I was like, hey, you want to dance? And we went out into the middle of the floor, and it was just the two of us dancing. And I became the coolest dude in the school after that. And I associated that with alcohol. You know, I started to associate intimacy and attention with drinking. I also, you know, used to get picked on a lot when I was a kid. There was these bullies, and they were like, you know, them and their father used to like, were in the meth manufacturing business, and those guys lived up the street from me, and they used to pick on me all the time. But once I started partying with them, it kind of saved me, you know. They didn't pick on me anymore because I was rolling with them. So I started associating getting loaded with safety and belonging. And I had to have that in order to just be alive, you know. But like I said, it started to take everything away from me. And then in the end, I just ended up on my couch, just not being able to move. You know, I know what powerlessness is. I remember lying on my couch thinking, just get up, man, get up, go, get a job, do something, man, get up. And I couldn't. I would just lie there. I was unable to. I got to the point where I didn't want to see you. I didn't want you to know what I had become. I hated myself. Hated me. I couldn't go out and get a job. I didn't want you to know who I was. And then conversely, I'd tell myself, don't get up. Don't you get up right now and go to the liquor store again. Don't you do that. And then my feet would just start walking. And I'd be at the liquor store again at 7 in the morning with that guy who knew me with that little plastic bottle of vodka telling myself, no, don't do this again. Stop. And I would just do it anyway. Tears would roll down my face. And there I was again, you know, just not being able to stop. So eventually what happened is I fell on the floor one day in my apartment. My knees buckled, and I looked up at the ceiling, and I said, God, you got to help me. I don't know what to do. And I opened up to a buddy of mine. I was like, dude, I need to go to rehab or something, man. I'm desperate. I'll do anything. I'll do absolutely anything. I have to stop. And he's like, don't go to rehab, man. Call my friend Doug. He's in AA. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. Do you have any other options? And he's like, no, well, he's open about this. You know, he said, call if he has anybody. I was like, I don't know. And so I tried other things. I went to a doctor, blah, blah, blah. Couldn't figure it out. I finally called that guy, Doug. He sent me to Sunday, Ohio. And he called up Eddie D. And he's like, Eddie D., this dude's coming. Give him a big book and a meeting directory. Show him what we do. And Eddie circled the meetings. And he said, I'll be at Monday night tomorrow. I'll see you there. I was like, okay. And I remember trying to put those okays back in my mouth. I didn't want to say okay. I didn't want to go to the meeting. I didn't want to come here, man. I was so angry, so pissed. I remember going to Ohio Street the very first night, and I just put my face up against the bricks in the very back row because it was cool. And I was just radiating. I was radiating with anger. I hated every single thing about this place. Hated it. Hated it. And I started listening. You know, I started listening to the people at podiums and lecterns and weird rooms around LA. And I finally started to hear the laughter, you know, and that intrigued me because I hadn't laughed in like years. And started doing the things, you know. And my sponsor was very smart at the beginning. He was like, dude, no matter what you think, we're going to do the opposite of that. Because I had a lot of great ideas, and I would show him all these reasons why I'm right. And he'd be like, yeah, well, we're going to start with the opposite of that. And so I just started doing the thing, and slowly, 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 I started to get better. Inch by inch, moment by moment, day by day, things just started to get a little bit better. And now, 12 years later, things are great. You know, I walk around happy most of the time. I walk around with real gratitude. I have, you know, I used to have that laser beam pointing at me all the time, like, you suck all the time. And now I've learned to point that back out at you, and if I'm service to you, then I feel great. In a good way. In a good way. You know, the last thing he told me is that this whole thing is about having a spiritual experience, and I didn't want your spiritual experience. I don't want your God. And right at the very end, I'll close with this. I asked a guy, you know, what's your spiritual experience like? He's like, well, God is infinite and omnipresent, and that includes you. He's endless and everywhere. You're not separate from anything. As a matter of fact, you're part of everything. That's something I didn't expect, man, and that carries me day by day along with all of you guys. So thanks for letting me share, guys.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Debbie C.
I'm Debbie Colton, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Mary, for inviting me to share my story. It's appropriate. It's appropriate that it's tonight. But I will start at the beginning. I grew up in a normal household in the Midwest, but I was the one that was different. I had two twin sisters who were older and the only boy in a very athletic family, younger. My parents would have kept on having children until they had that boy. My dad had played pro ball. That's just what it was. I became his best buddy. At 15, I was offered a beer by my father. Now, I'm the only alcoholic that I know of in my family. So I started at 15, and amazing things seemed to have started happening for me. I was given power and control and put in charge of things, and I got to leave high school early and go to college, and I was drinking all the time. I will tell you, I drank alcoholically from the get-go. In high school, my dad bought the great big, I think they're called handles today, of liquor, kept it downstairs and put it into quarts under the sink in the kitchen. So I would spend my evenings downstairs watching TV in the basement, drinking his booze and filling it up with water. I could drink and drive. I would be the designated driver after we all went out and drank. So I get to college and I just keep it up. I'm putting myself through college working in bars. And I had what was then called a Pell Grant. So I had to teach for 2 years after college. And I came back and did that, and teaching doesn't pay very much. So I couldn't really afford to drink, and I was too exhausted to go work in a bar all night. So it kind of calmed down, but what I really wanted to do was be in the music business. So as soon as I'd done my 2 years in that grant, did not turn into a loan, it was just disappeared, I came to California and got a job in the entertainment business, got a job at the Troubadour, learned how to do many things that I was very surprised by, including make tips. I couldn't understand how all the other women were making tips, and they finally told me after about 3 months. And then I got the job of my dreams because I'd figured out who everybody was. I went to work for a major management company. I always wanted to be in the business of music, and my drinking really took off. We thought it was a good idea to have a couple pitchers of margaritas at lunch and go back and do our best work. Now, I rode that job, and I was the designated female junior account executive, and I rode that job to amazing heights. I got married to my musician from the Midwest, who also had a good job. Oh, but he didn't drink. He smoked pot, but he also didn't like the expensive drugs, the more expensive drugs. So we had an interesting life because he was on the road a lot. He never said a word to me about my drinking or using. And then I blew up my job. I came back after a major tour, and they told me that my secretary had been fired and I was going to do contracting again. How dare you do that to me? Don't you know who I am? They said, you do it or you're fired. And I said, I quit. I did peace work for a little while, and then an amazing thing happened. My husband said, why don't we start a family? And God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. I got pregnant. I could not use or smoke or drink. I was clean. I was scared. And it worked out. A wonderful group of a parent association was put in my path. I was sober. I had two children. And then things started to change. I went back to work. I started to drink a little bit. My 4.5-year-old asked me one night why I drank all the wine every night. 4.5. She's 40 now. I took that into marriage counseling because I was pretty sure I was working because of him, right? He wasn't doing a good enough job. Marriage counselor said, well, maybe you're an alcoholic. You should go to AA. I went to my first meeting. It wasn't Roxbury, but it was a park in Beverly Hills, and I saw the 12 steps, and I saw the traditions, and I said, what a way to live. This is for everyone. Except that I was going to do it my way. That was in 1986. I spent 30 years doing it my way. A lot of it abstinent, but the book says it's all in the book. It's very clear. It's very simple. It's repeated over and over. Half measures avail us nothing. So periodically, my life would just reel out of control. And I would drink because people, places, and institutions weren't doing it my way. It just wasn't what I wanted. Selfish, self-centered. My husband tolerated it. We've been married 44 years. Now, no one ever said anything to me. No one ever said to me, wow, your drinking's out of control. Your drug use is bad. What he did say to me was, all those bills you racked up during a little cocaine break, you got to pay the money back. Oh, yeah, I've been stealing from my kids. That was after 8 years of not drinking, going to meetings, resenting the meetings, not identifying with you, reading the book, doing half measures. It just didn't work. So in maybe 2013, my son came to me after one binge, came into my room. Now, I had restraining orders against him, thrown him out of the house numerous times. Big difference of opinion how we should deal with this young man. And I was hungover, and I said, the only thing I can tell you is go to AA. That young man has 3.5 years sober today, and I'm so grateful. My sobriety date is December 16th, 2016. On the 15th, I decided I had not been drinking for a while, but things had gotten, we had a very sick dog, and I was very angry, and we were spending money like water, and I'd been up for maybe 36 hours with this sick puppy, couldn't get him to take the pills. I decided that my husband's advice and suggestions weren't good enough. I took a drink. I slammed the door. I left the dog with him. The next morning, I am getting the carcass, the body, out of our very cold swimming pool. And I could not blame him for leaving the door open. It was me, and it was taking a drink, and I recognized that. and my mind. I was hallucinating. I couldn't stop crying. I went back to my meetings. I stood up as a newcomer. Wasn't the first time. But I knew that I was insane. And that was the first time that I was able to recognize in the steps, 1, 2, and 3, what was happening. Now, I had watched some women go through a specific treatment program. I couldn't wait to get in there. But I had to, because I wasn't willing to go to detox. I was afraid of the pills. I was afraid that they might sedate me or say that I was crazy. I didn't want to go to detox. I just wanted to go to treatment. I just wanted help. So it took a little while. I was in meetings all the time. I got into treatment. I was there 27 days. They put me on days, and they said, you have to have a meeting every night in your neighborhood, and you have to get a sponsor before we'll let you do IOP, which is outpatient, a more specified outpatient program. And that's when I met my sponsor, first night out. Donna D was the speaker at the lottery meeting, and I went to coffee. I was going to interview. I'd been looking for a friend. My other sponsors always disappointed me because they weren't my friend. Donna took me through the steps. She did it the Pacific way, the Pacific group way. She told me what meeting to go to. She did not make it too difficult, but she was very specific. And that's all the time I have, but I have to thank Kimberly for starting a meeting and introducing me to all my sober sisters. I have a family now, and I just went to my first Sweet 16 class party, and I am proud to say that the Pacific Group is my home group. And thank you all for being here. I never have to pick up a drink because you can all get me through this as long as I do it your way, our way. Thank you.
Speaker tonight is Nathan D.
Yeah. Everyone, I'm Nathan. I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here tonight, sober. Thank you, Mary, for asking me to speak here. It's a big deal for me to speak here at this meeting. If you know me, you know I don't love speaking, but I don't really care speaking in other meetings. But speaking here at this meeting is a little bit different for me. I did something I normally don't do tonight. I laid out 3 suits and asked my wife which one to wear. So if you don't like it, you could talk to her. I even wore my lucky St. Patrick's Day socks. And I know the tie doesn't match, but it's my Uncle Bill's, and it's special to me, and only wear it on really important evenings. Anyway, this meeting matters to me because, like Sharon, I got sober a year. My first meeting was February 16th, 1985. That's a class of 85 clapping. I don't remember that meeting, but now with the iPhone, you can go back and see it was Saturday nights. It was the Way of Life group, and I have no memory of that. My first 6 months were pretty foggy. Like Jack, I was not a happy newcomer. I was very angry. And I didn't get it. I didn't understand AA. When I got sober, my life had been much worse. Wish they'd crank the AC up here in a little bit. I don't know. Seems a little toasty up here. But anyway, when I got sober, my life was kind of bad, but not that. It had been worse previously. I was just newly homeless. I had some warrants and some debt. I had a old bicycle that you didn't need to lock up. Nobody would steal it. And I had a pillowcase with some clothes in it. And that was it. And but I felt like it wasn't that bad. And I didn't want to get sober. I didn't want to stop drinking. And I would sit around in AA, and I would just sit back there angry and just character assassinate everybody, you know. And I would pester old timers with questions, right? Like we would say, "Keep coming back, it works." And I say, "What's it? Like, what is Alcoholics Anonymous, right?" And nobody could really answer me, right? Like I would say, Clancy used to say, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to reduce his feelings of differences, to convince him to take a set of actions that he doesn't already believe in, right? But even that didn't really explain it to me. Like, I didn't get it. And I was kind of obsessed with it, and I read all the conference-approved literature. I read a bunch of other books. I read Ed Downing and Bill Wilson's letters to each other and Carl Jung's letters. And nobody could tell me what AA was. And it kind of drove me crazy. You know, what is just a bunch of dope sitting around telling drunk stories and drinking coffee. I believe that a lot of people die from alcoholism because AA cannot really be intellectualized. In my opinion, it can't be intellectualized. It can only be experienced. Right? We take a set of actions that we don't believe in. Right? I called Chuck Nesbitt was my first sponsor. I'd call up Chuck. Say, "I don't have money for food or rent." He'd say, "Go to the yard and help Clancy fix a gate." Right? And I think sponsors have a serious listening problem. Like they don't hear what we're saying. Right? I'd say, "Hey man, how the hell is fixing a gate gonna pay my rent?" Right? So, you know, Vince Yo used to say, we need I wish you the gift of desperation, right? Because in the beginning, I almost didn't need the steps. I needed sponsorship, I needed direction, and I needed fellowship, right? Because I had no life, right? I was living on my drug dealer's floor in Venice. My stripper girlfriend left back to Vegas. She said I was a loser. And so, like, I had really nothing to do. So Chuck Nesbitt made me go to 15 meetings a week, the morning meeting at the Marina Center, the PG nighttime meeting, noon meeting on Sunday. I went to the yard and the moves and the watches and all that stuff. And I just stayed sober on direction and fellowship. And so I took these actions and my life began to change, right? Like when I was new, I thought about drinking every minute of every day. Like I'm talking, I have an overactive mind. Like my mind is 100 miles an hour all the time. In my first 8 months, I thought of three things: sex, murder, and alcohol. That's all I thought about. And I would think like today's the day. I'm drinking. I can't take it anymore. And this isn't real. This doesn't work. This is just it's a bunch of smoke and mirrors. It's not real. And so I was about 8 months sober, 6 to 8 months sober. It's hard to remember. I'm in the right field at the yard. I got a resentment because I think I'm better than the third baseman and the shortstop. And I realized I was having conversations in my head like I always do, especially back then. And I was thinking, this Clancy guy, he's not a bad guy. Let's all these blank come over to his house every Saturday and they look like they're a pain in the ass. And then I remember my head's like, "Hey, what's with all these good thoughts, man? What are you doing?" And I said, "No, seriously, the guy's not bad." And it had hit me that day that I hadn't thought about drinking in a couple of days. You know, that I was just kind of walking with everybody else, and the obsession for alcohol just kind of left me. But anyway, I do love AA. Like, I would sit there new, and people would say, "I love AA," and I would want to just beat the crap out of them in the parking lot, you know, and I hated it. I hated AA, and I think what they mean and what I mean is I got Trisha's phone. It's on airplane mode, so I just need to see the clock, so, and a picture of my kids. So I think when I say I love AA, I mean I love what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for my life, right? So I came to AA a complete and total loser. I'd never been anything before AA. I'd just been a little juvenile delinquent, criminal, little asshole, and nothing. I was of no use to society. I provided nothing. I was just a drain on society. I was a bad person. And I come into AA, and my recovery is slow, very, very slowly. But I tried to do these things. I tried to do these actions that they tell us to do, and my life got better and better and better and better and better. And my life today, it's amazing. Like, it's unbelievable. And I'll talk about it in a minute. So when I say I love AA, I do love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's unique. Someday I'd like to give a talk just on AA. It's unlike any organization in the world. I could give you 50 examples of how no other DMV, law, school, nothing is like Alcoholics Anonymous, right? We're unique in every sense of the word, but that's not tonight. So anyway, my talk, my story goes like this. My little tale of woe begins in Northeast New Jersey. I'm the youngest of six kids. I got four older brothers, one older sister. In my family, eight people, two women, two female, six male. The six men are alcoholics. I wasn't too sure about my brother Chris, but I've changed my mind recently. My dad, he died with 48 years of sobriety. I got two sober brothers. Steve is in and out. And Chris, you know, he needs to go to some meetings, but he's a little defiant. Then my mother and sister are not alcoholic, and that's just the way it was in my house. So to tell my story, I got to tell a little bit about my dad's story. My dad was a great, great guy. He was number four of eight, son of Irish immigrants. They settled in Pittsburgh, just your classic blue-collar Irish family. My grandmother was a second-floor maid in Shadyside, the rich neighborhood in Pittsburgh, and my grandfather was a construction laborer till he got hired by the Pittsburgh PD. Was a cop. They said he'd go out and just beat people up all the time and not arrest too many people. Just your typical story. The Irish are big on education. Everybody in that family, except my Uncle Henry, graduated college. My dad was in the seminary for 4 years. His older brother was a priest. His younger sister was a nun. In fact, my son Danny is named after my Uncle Dan, the priest. But anyway, they said, you're not a priest material. You should try the army, then come back and see us when you're done. And he was in Korea. He had a four-year degree, so he was a clerk. He could type and do some stuff. He didn't do any fighting. He was on the baseball team and boxing team in the Army. And he was in Fort Dix, New Jersey. And a guy said, instead of going to Pittsburgh on leave, why don't you come home with me? He went home with him. His name was Philip Juchter to Demarest, New Jersey. Met his sister Carol, became my mother. And that was it for the priesthood. My father and my mother went back to Pittsburgh. He got a master's in philosophy. Went back to New York. He graduated Fordham Law School. He told me he has no memory of taking the New York State Bar. Said he took it in a blackout. Passed the bar, went to NYU, got an advanced law degree at NYU Law School. So he was a brilliant guy, my dad. And about 3 years after that, he was pretty much a wino, drinking wine in an alley behind a liquor store in Westwood, New Jersey, an alley that I frequented years later. Did a little drinking in myself. And I moved to New Jersey in 1991. Maybe we'll talk about that later. But I met a guy at the Hackensack Firehouse meeting on Saturday morning. Tim Doherty was an old Irish guy. Used to go to the Mustard Seed in Manhattan with Bill Wilson. How's that for a connection? And he would come get my dad out of that alley and take him to the Park Ridge Group on Wednesday night, every Wednesday night in Park Ridge, New Jersey, and bring my dad drunk to the meeting. He said he did it for 2 to 3 years. So my mother divorced my father, obviously, they challenged, my dad challenged the divorce. Like I said, he's a brilliant guy. It went to the Supreme Court of the United States. They didn't hear it, but they wrote a decision while they upheld the New Jersey State Supreme Court's thing. So in 1970, January 1970, the divorce was final, and that was my dad's sobriety date. Alcoholic irony, huh? So I don't remember any of that. I was 5 years old. I have no memory. I just like listening to stories, and, you know, I get stories from different family members and kind of put the pieces together. But I do remember one of my earliest memories. They celebrate anniversaries different in New Jersey. They do. So this is Wednesday night. So the last Wednesday of the month, you would, if you celebrated, and they call them AA anniversaries, not birthdays, you get a giant cake. Every home group member would put their name on the cake. And some home groups go around to support other home groups' anniversary night. And then you come up and you pin the the guy taking the cake, this, they call them pigeons back there because pigeons always on their sponsors. So they would pin it. The pigeon would talk, the sponsor would talk, and that's how they celebrate them. So I was six at the time. This would have been 1971, and my nickname was Pudge. I was kind of a fat kid, stuttered a lot, kind of a nervous, jumpy, twitchy kind of kid. And there's a giant cake right there, and I was obsessed with sweets. I still am obsessed with sweets. Right there, and I wanted to stick my finger in it, but this mean guy was looking at me, and I remember it was a long, smoky room, and my dad was at the podium talking, and we talked about it, and we think that he took me to see him celebrate his first AA anniversary. So he couldn't come around the house. My mother divorced him. He could only come on Sunday. So he'd take us to Mass, and then he'd take us to the Hudson River. We'd go hiking, and we'd buy hot dogs, rolls, and Shasta Cola, and we'd hike up the trail that George Washington actually came down from West Point. Anyway, we'd hike up, we'd light a campfire, cook them, eat them, and then we'd swim in the Hudson River, which was very dirty back at the time, and just normal to us. And I enjoyed those times. It was good times. But so at my house, everybody just got loaded. Everybody drank and got high all the time, right? So I got four older brothers, and for my perspective, these guys, they were just four big, strong guys who kind of told people what to do. People listened to them. And my brother Mike is here tonight. He never talks about this when he talks, but he was a big-time drug dealer in that town. And funny, well, I've heard him talk many times. He doesn't talk about it, but I don't know. Maybe he's being humble or something. But I can give you a couple eyewitness accounts. And in my basement, Louis Rodriguez, he graffitied the whole basement with Looney Tune characters, you know, like Bugs Bunny with a bong, Daffy Duck shooting up, and they had black lights and strobe lights and just playing Black Sabbath, and like, it was just, you know, every day, anytime, Tuesday, 10 a.m., Sunday, 2 p.m., Wednesday, you know, somebody was getting loaded in my basement. And it just seemed like our house was a hub for all the future alcoholic, drug addict delinquents in the community to come to. And so a small town in New Jersey, and everybody would tell their kids, don't hang out. My name was Little Dixon, right? Don't hang out with the Little Dixon. He's bad news, right? And which is good advice. I have three kids, and if we had a family like that in my community, I'd give them the same advice. And so I grew up in this thing, and it was just a crazy-ass house. I mean, just insanity. I'm not really in the mood to get into it tonight, but it was just we were stealing from each other, fighting, just nuts. And you know, I grew up in that house. It's obvious I'm going to drink and get loaded. So, like I said, I stuttered really bad. I was nervous. I was jumpy. They had me on Ritalin and all kinds of drugs. I couldn't sit still in school. And when I drank alcohol, all that stuff went away. So I had this, I like to say, I can't come up with a better way to describe it. So I don't know if you're old enough to remember the cartoon, The Jetsons. George Jetson had that little Martian that used to float around on his shoulder, right? And he would always, like, give him ideas. So I had this little guy on my shoulder, and he was like a critic, right? He's always like, nobody likes you. You're a loser. You look funny. You got a big zit right on your forehead. You know, just always negative, 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 just grinding the crap out of me 24/7. And when I drank alcohol, the critic became my biggest supporter. Right, he would just kind of put his arm around my head and, you know, chicks dig you, you know, you're the man, everybody likes you. And I drank alcohol because it just turned the volume down in my head. I loved the effect produced by alcohol. I absolutely loved it. I just, from the very beginning, it just calmed me down. Sober, I didn't like people. I didn't want to be around people. I couldn't talk to people. When I was drinking, I could be right in the middle of the party. I could dance. I just loved it. I absolutely, positively loved it. So I drank all the time. I drank every chance I got. I didn't go to school, didn't have a job, didn't pretend I had a family. I had a girlfriend, but didn't really, didn't act that way. I pretty much, the way I drank was I did what I wanted to do, when I wanted to do it, to whomever I wanted to do it to. And so I didn't really have any kind of crazy fears about fighting or I had no morals or no monetary value. Like I just drank all the time, and I'd get a little bit excited. I'd get kind of crazy when I drank. And so the police I would draw the attention of the police frequently. So I just got locked up all the time. You know, it started out with little stuff, you know, and then just got bigger and bigger stuff, and fighting and assault charges. So probably 6 years went like that, you know, just drinking every chance I got, you know, getting locked up. So pretty much my alcoholic resume is I was in Bergen County Juvenile Detention about 40 times. I was in a little kid's thing for like 2 years, 3 psychiatric hospitals and 4 rehabs. And so I had some drug charges and some theft and some B&E and all those things. And my mother, my mother was a very attractive woman. She's a good looking woman. And she should have been an actor. Like anyway, I'll just tell you this story. I had a bunch of assault charges, and they were going to lock me up for a while. And then some people didn't testify. And then I turned 18 and I beat some guy up pretty good. And the judge was going to sentence me to 3 years at like a medium kind of prison, right, for this assault charge. So my mother, I was coming into the courtroom. She was always flirting with the bailiffs at the courthouse, right? And so I'm coming in, and I had this light blue suit on that was kind of worn out from being, I only wore it to court, and the suit was getting worn out. And my mother was out there with the Virginia Slim, flirting with the bailiffs, talking to them and stuff. And I come into court, and it's this skinny little judge, and he hated my guts, right? And it's his job to lock people like me up, like I should have been locked up. And so, you know, he's yelling at me, and I'm trying to look sad. And so my mother, she's sobbing uncontrollably, just unconsolable, right? She, my baby never had a chance. And, you know, back then the mascara ran, so, you know, she looks like Alice Cooper, right? And she got tears stains on her boobs, right? And she's like he grew up in his home and he never had a chance. And so the judge, he wanted to lock me up bad, but he couldn't say no to my mother. And she could be convincing when she wanted to. So God bless her, she got me out of jail one more time. And they sent me to this rehab in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, called Today Incorporated. And I used to go back there and speak. It's not there anymore, but so it was torture for me. The place was just a nightmare. So every place I had been had my medication, right? I'd been on medication since the first grade. And so I'm even, you know, detention, jail, everywhere I had my medication. All the other places I went to were like, there were some shrinks at the rehabs, and they gave me medication. This place was a house, a farmhouse converted, and it was all recovered people, a couple non-alcoholics, but no doctors, so no medication, right? So I'm like, I'm pretty antsy, you know, I'm uptight. And they said, one threat of violence, one act of violence, and you're going to jail. Right? So I was miserable. I was a different level miserable. And I'm just negative. When do I stop? So I bought a clock, but I don't know when to stop, so it doesn't really help me very much. But it looks good. I keep checking the clock like I care, right? So there's a big clock there. So I'm in this place, and I got this section in the woods with all these plants. Somebody told me something about jimson weed, so I'm trying to smoke this stuff and trying to make this. Like, you know, on TV, you see him making, like, wine in prison and trying to taste like crap. And so I'm just going nuts. And so I'm miserable and unhappy, and I hate it in there. And I'll tell you the worst thing about this place. So they said I never talked about my feelings, right? They said I never talked about my feelings. I never let anybody see the real Nathan, right? Which is, I was more than happy to show them the real Nathan. But anyway, so the family would get together before every meal. And they did this. I'd rather take a beating than go to therapy, right? And they would make me do this every three times a day. So I'd have to sit in a circle and I have to say, letting people in is simply a matter of not expending the energy to keep people out. Today I let in, I'm supposed to say how I let people in and see me. So I'd say things like, today I let in Joey by telling him I think he's an asshole. And so the family votes me to leave, right? The family says, you're gone, you're beyond help. I'm laying in bed that night, and all the old tapes are running through my head. This is a significant day in my life. And so all the old tapes are going through my head, and I'm thinking about, you know, I was home. I didn't have a place to live once. My sister rented a house with two other women. They put deadbolts on the bedroom doors before they let me sleep on the couch. First day in there, I stole all their gold jewelry. Sold my dad's high school ring for $14. Just all these petty little crappy things. Some, you know, respectable things I stole. But just all these old tapes are running through my head, and a voice in my head says, if you didn't drink and use drugs, you wouldn't have all these problems. And up to that point in my life, I had never considered the fact that drugs and alcohol were the reason my life was so screwed up. I had, you know, alkies are the best rationalizers and justifiers on the planet. And I had reasons why my life was screwed up, but it most certainly wasn't because of my drinking and drug use. So from that day to this, I cannot deny the fact that alcohol just about killed me. And so it destroyed my life, just about killed me. So there was an old lady, you know, she's probably about 35, 40 at the time, but seemed old to me, Deborah Rogers, some old heroin addict lady working the night shift, and I stayed up all night talking to her. And the family decided to give me a second chance in the morning. And just even saying the family today drives me crazy because, you know, they weren't my family. But anyway, it was a 6-month program. I graduated in 9 months. And so there was a little shift occurred, tiny shift occurred. I did not want to be sober, but I didn't want to go to prison. Like I was on what I would consider to be like I was going to do longer and longer prison sentences because I my behavior. And so I kind of wanted to change, but I certainly didn't want to get sober. So couldn't go to Jersey, couldn't stay in Philly. My oldest brother, Fran, was out in Santa Monica. So they shipped me out here to live with him, and he had a tiny little apartment. You know, God bless him, we'd lean a mattress up against the wall during the day, lay it down at night. He'd have to step over me to get to the bathroom. He never made me feel like I was putting him out. And so I was there for a few months. They said, go to AA meetings, look for somebody who looks like they have what you want, ask that guy to be your sponsor. I knew nothing about AA, nothing. So I go to a meeting, just randomly pick a meeting, see some guys talking to three young women, and I said, excuse me, would you be my sponsor? So he, you know, a week or two later, we're at his apartment, and he says, now we're going to kneel down and pray. And it was like me and him alone in the apartment. I'm like, what? So I left in the middle of the third step. I think it was the third step. So a couple days later, I meet some girl. She's at her first AA meeting. we're hanging out. She says, I feel like getting loaded. I'm like, haha, you're not the only one. So it's hard for me to put a timeline on it, you know, because had I known I was going to talk about this stuff, I might have kept some notes or something. But anyway, I had moved next door to my brother. I had a number 8, had a nice little apartment. I had a car, a motorcycle, a job, a phone, a closet with some clothes in it, just the beginnings of a normal life, right? And, you know, I was pretty intense. I work hard, and so I can earn a little bit of money. And so I think it was about 6 months. I was on my drug dealer's floor in Venice. It was February 16th, 1985. I'd had some fights in the neighborhood. I was making him nervous. My girlfriend went back to Vegas. He's like, you got to go, right? So I'm down on Venice Beach. It's the morning. I got nowhere to go, nothing to do. I'm like, so New Jersey back then. It's unbelievable. So I'm like, Venice Beach, what the hell is this place? Like the circus, right? So I call up my brother Mike. So Mike, he had failed out of a rehab in Denver and had taken my spot on Fran's floor in the mattress, right? So I call up Mike and I'm like, give me some money. Right. And I don't exactly remember how the conversation went, but it goes something like this. He goes, I think he said, call me back in 10 minutes. So I call him back. He's like, check it out. I'll get your old job back. I'll get you a place to stay. You go to a meeting every night. You drink one time. Don't ever call me again. And I remember thinking, you dick. I'm going to beat your ass. I was so angry. I like being force-fed Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, this is the last place I want to go, AA, right? And I needed $5. That's all I needed. $5, get the job started. I'll finish the rest. I'll take it from there. And but at the time, I didn't have a better plan. I couldn't get to Jersey. If I could get to Jersey, I probably could have got a little hustle going. But so I'm like, whatever. So I come to AA and pretend I'm an alcoholic. I didn't believe I was, didn't think I was, and I hated it. I hated being here. I hated you. But the person I hated most was Nathan Dixon. I hated myself because I felt like I'd been given some talent and some opportunity, and I just threw it down the toilet. And I was hard on myself, and I just would constantly just in my head, just grinding away, you total loser, look at you. I slept on a guy named Mark Haycock's floor. He slept on his floor for about 4 months. He's a good AA member till he quit going to meetings, took some meds, and hung himself up in Seattle. But on a happier note, I didn't. So I guess I didn't quit going to meetings. So I rented a room in some lady's house in Santa Monica, and I had some stupid ass job, and I couldn't sleep. My first year, I couldn't sleep more than 2 hours, and I would. Once I got a ticket for riding a bicycle through a red light, we were doing Christmas cards at Mike's apartment. I was riding home. 1 a.m, I go through a stop sign on a bicycle. The cop gives me a ticket. I'm like, what the hell? And but the first couple of years were great for me because I didn't have a life. I didn't have a life. And here's one of the great mysteries of my life, right? The way I grew up, the culture I grew up in, if you can beat my ass, I do what you say. If I can beat your ass, you do what I say. So in 1985 in the Pacific Group, there was nobody who could physically make me do anything I did not want to do, right? So I'm in a meeting one day, minding my own business. All of a sudden, this old guy just starts breaking my balls for no reason, right? He's like, you need to shave. You need to cut your hair. You need to wear a coat and tie. Like, just telling me all these things to do, like 15 meetings a week and go to the yard. He actually said, I had my old job back, and he would say, you're going to take your paycheck, you're going to sign it, and you're going to write on the back, pay to the order of Chuck Nesbitt, and I'm going to give you the money that you need. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, Chuck. Right? So I don't know why I did it. I don't know why I did it. There's no PG police. There's no AA police going to come make you do it. I mean, I just, for some reason, I knew when I must have known the way my life was going, and I must have known I needed help. And the reason Chuck had to handle my money was because we got paid on the 1st and the 15th, and I was broke on the 2nd and the 16th every month, right? Rent or go buy some clothes, right? That's So anyway, so if you're an alcoholic and you subject yourself to the will of a sponsor's direction, your life's going to get better, right? So my life's got better. And for me, it was a slow grind. So I couldn't settle down. I couldn't get into California, and I just didn't feel like I fit in California. So I said, I'm going to move to New Jersey, right? So everybody says, probably a bad idea, but you know, Alkies, we're going to do what we're going to do, right? So in 1991, I moved to New Jersey. It was not a successful trip, except for one really, really good thing came out of New Jersey. Now, most of you know me, know I've been married to Trish we just celebrated 27 years of marriage, and she said she'll only come tonight if I don't talk about her from the podium. So anyway, August 12th, 1991, I'm at an AA meeting in Demarest, New Jersey. See this lovely young woman walking in the door. And I said, she looks nice. And so everybody thinks in New Jersey, you say, how you doing? But I said, what's up? And so I told my son that when we met, there were no cell phones and no pagers, that the phones were actually attached to wires, and you had to go to where the phone was to make a phone call, right? That's how long we've been together. But I asked her for her phone number that night at the meeting. She told me to look it up. And we started dating almost straight away. And I was working one day. I was back there for about 6 months. The AA back there is horrible. It sucks. It just... they drink near beer. They go to strip clubs after the meetings. I mean, once I wore a suit to speak, and they're like, "Yo, Nathan, where'd you go to court today?" And I'm like, "No, I'm speaking." They're like, "The hell you got a suit on for?" And I'm just like, "Oh man." So I'm working. I'm back there about 6 months, and I'm working. And the voice says to me, "You're gonna drink if you stay in New Jersey." And I moved back to California. I moved to Los Angeles for the single reason of being a Pacific group. I mean, I moved back in 1992 for the just to be in this group, to be a part of this group, because I know I need to be sober. I don't have many fears. I'm lucky I don't have a ton of fears, but I'm afraid to drink. I'm afraid of really two things, earthquakes and alcohol. I'm afraid to drink alcohol because I've admitted to my innermost self that if I take one shot of Jack Daniels, one can of Budweiser, in a very short time, I'll lose everything. I'll lose my marriage, my children, my home, my career, my self-worth, my dignity. I know that my life will turn to a steaming, it will not be good. So that's why I do, that's why I get up here and speak. Don't love it. It's a little uncomfortable. You see me sweating like crazy. It's I tell you, I'm not sure why I sweat, but I can tell you, I've been in, my buddy stabbed an off-duty cop. We spent all night getting interrogated, been interrogated by all kinds of cops, lied in court, all those times, never once cracked a sweat, lying. I stand in AA meeting, I tell the truth, I'm just sweating like crazy. For a kid from Jersey, it's an unnatural act to tell the truth, right? And so my life today, so I stayed here. I came back to be a member of the Pacific Group, and I stayed here. And I've had these great sponsors. There's a bunch of stuff I wanted to talk about tonight. It just kind of, I don't know, it didn't happen. But I wanted to talk about a little bit of the history of the Pacific Group. So I got sober in 85. So in the late 80s and early 90s, the Pacific Group was a very unique place in Alcoholics Anonymous. There were 30, 40 like AA legends, like legendary guys. The meeting was 1,000 to 1,100 people every week. And there were just the greatest AAs in the world were in our meeting every week. And I just wish I could have got my head out of my ass a little sooner to learn more from them. But I feel like I walk around most of the time now, I'd say 90% of the time, with an overwhelming sense of gratitude for the way my life has turned out. I believe that God's been very merciful to me. There's a loving God in my life, and he has, you know, one of my prayers in the morning is let me show other people you put in my life today the same mercy you've shown me, right? And I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in California. Like, so I've made decisions in my life that I did not have the life experience, the knowledge, or the understanding to make those decisions. And yet those decisions happened for me and have worked out amazing. I'll give you one example. So some of my ex-girlfriends, I would walk a mile out of my way to avoid them. They're crazy, and I want nothing to do with them, right? So people used to say, oh, don't meet women in AA. AA women are crazy. First of all, you should look at the guys who are saying that. Those guys, not the best catch in the room, ladies. So I meet my wife at an AA meeting, and she is the single most important person in my life. Right. And we have it's been 30 years. We've been dating and married for 27 years. We had three children. Two of them graduated college. One's a junior at Fordham now, doing pretty good. Could do better. You know, for me, I'm always like, well, you could do a little better. I do that to myself. So that's kind of why I do it. But it's I feel my life today is you know, my job's fine. It's busy. I'm grateful for it. My family's exceptional. I don't have a single resentment. I tried to do a four-step with somebody a few months ago. I couldn't come up with a single. I did like really reach to come up with some stupid-ass resentments, like gas prices are too high, right? And anyway, it's time for me to stop. I just want to say thank you. Thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you to the Pacific Group. Thank you to Trish. I love you. You're the best. I love my life. I love being sober. And if there's one thing you could take from my talk, it's hope. I came in a complete and total loser. Like I'm talking like just a different level loser. And my life is really, really, really good today. Good evening.
So our first birthday is for Drake K for 1 year.
Hi, I'm Drake, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Toby. I love you, man, and the Road Dogs.
Our second birthday is for Donnie H. for 2 years.
Hi, Donnie Hewlett, alcoholic. I want to thank my sponsor, Tim, Dr. David, and all you guys. Thank you much.
Our next birthday is for Liz Z. for 3 years.
Wow. Hi, Liz, alcoholic. I want to thank God, first of all, and for all his divine appointments, and especially introducing me to my new sponsor, Yvonne Schulte, and all of you. Thank you.
Our next birthday is for 11 years for Damon D.
My name is Damon. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, God. Thank you, John. Thank you to my lovely bride. And thank you to all of you for your shares, keeping Alcoholics Anonymous alive.
Our next birthday is for 13 years for William B.
William Alcoholic. I want to thank God, my sponsor, John, and all of you guys. Thank you.
Our next birthday is for 15 years for Grace L.
My name is Grace, and I'm an alcoholic. Those fake candles kill me. I want to thank my amazing sponsor, Hilda, for always holding the bar high for me. I want to thank my amazing grand sponsor, Sharon, for teaching me what it's like to be a lady with dignity and grace. Thank you. My seatmate, Ryan, back there, and Clancy for the structure of the group. Thank you.
Our next birthday is for a man who said that tonight we were dressed alike. I don't know how he thought that. It's for 20 years for PJ.
That's what we kind of matched.
Hi, PJ Alcoholic. Thank you, God, for a count of 20 through the years of good and plenty. Thank you, Tom, for taking my calls, hearing my gripes, and catching my falls. Thanks, David B. and the office crew. You keep me in line while doing the do. Thanks, PG, for leading the way. Boy, am I lucky to have found my way. And one more thing, girls and boys. I'm doing my best to make some no noise.
Thank you, PJ. For 21 years, our next cake for Anthony R.
Hi, I'm Anthony. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank my sponsor, Corey K. I want to thank PG, AA, and the memory of Casey Crane. Thank you.
Very sweet. Our next birthday is for 26 years for Richard G.
Hello, family. Hi. Richard Gellis, alcoholic. I want to thank God, of course, AA, PG, progenitor, PG, my previous sponsors, and my current sponsor, Jim. Thank you.
Our next birthday is also for 26 years for Michael P.
Michael Pascal, alcoholic. I want to thank Tim for another year of sponsorship. I was in and out of the group for 9 years, and 26 years ago, I crash-landed back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew I was too sick, and I knew it wasn't going to work, and then it happened, and AA has been the magical elixir that has washed away every problem in my life, and I found out that there's nothing wrong with me. I'm just an alcoholic. Thanks.
Our next birthday is for 32 years for JC.
My name's JC and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank God, Alcoholics Anonymous, Pacific Group, Bill for the last 26 years, all of you, class of 89.
And our last birthday is for a member of the greatest class of the Pacific Group, 44 years for our former secretary, Marty S.
My name is Marty. I'm an alcoholic. I thank Carl for taking on my case this year. I want to thank Clancy for many years of sponsorship, for the structure of this group, for the yard. I want to thank my lovely wife, the lovely Julie S., and all of you. Thanks.
We have one Zoom birthday for 41 years for Linda M., and Sharon C. is her sponsor. Okay.